It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. We start with a guy who has turned into one of the biggest stories of the 2016 postseason, and that is Corey Kluber. And it's interesting because there are two really different ways to come at Kluber, and you come at them at one, and I was actually kind of thinking of him in the other direction, and so I do think he's a guy we really should talk about because, as you note, 245 and a third innings all told since opening day, and that is something that has shown on guys, has been an issue for some pitchers in recent years, these guys who get pushed really deep into the postseason, and has been such a star in the postseason that you ask the question, is he going to be overrated draft day? And I think it's an interesting question for this reason. I think you can make a case that until now, Kluber has been underrated. I mean, yes, he only had 9 wins in 15, but other than that, you look at the numbers this guy has put up, consistently well north of 200 innings, 269 strikeouts, 245, 227, 244, 349, 314. This is not a guy, I think, that always gets talked about among the really top-level pitchers in baseball, but for me, what this postseason has done is sort of shine a light on the fact that in the sort of non-Kershaw division, he really is one of the truly elite starting pitchers in the game. And yet, I think you raise an interesting point, particularly with the workload question. So I think my answer to your question is I think maybe he'll be sort of properly rated coming into next year. What do you think, just as far as sort of reading people and what people will think about Kluber coming into 17?
Yeah, I tried to compare him, you know, in my head to Madison Bumgarner off his, you know, best postseason runs and how people viewed him the next season. And it really did push him, I felt like, up into maybe the top three or so starters. I guess maybe this is my question with Kluber. Should we rank Kluber any differently today than we would have ranked him on the final day of the regular season? Like, does this postseason, you said for you, maybe it's kind of cemented him as a, what do you think, like a top 10 starter? Is he a top 5 starter? Because I could see people going there now.
Well, I think maybe the better way, what I should have said is, it reminds me of how good he is. I don't think this month has necessarily strengthened his position. And I think, if anything, being rational, he might get a half a tick down for me because of those workload concerns. Though I would note, you know, again, he's not that high over what his innings total was in 14, which was in 6 months rather than 7. I think top 10 is perfectly reasonable for him. And again, I just think it's for me, what this has done is just kind of remind me of how good this guy is. And because I think he's, and I can't even really tell you why. Maybe it's just my own bias. I have sort of not seen him at the level of, again, those top, you know, he's certainly not a top 3 fantasy starter. You know, I'm not taking him over a Kershaw or a Scherzer or those guys. But, you know, whatever that real top tier is, I think you make a case that he is right in the next tier of starters.
Yeah, and what I saw from really early 2017 drafts, it seems like, yeah, Kershaw and Scherzer are untouched as the top two, and then it was a decent consensus on Bumgarner and Sale as the next two, and then Kluber in the next group, which is really like a hodgepodge of a bunch of different pitchers, and pick the one you like, whether you like Syndergaard or Arrieta, you know, and there were a lot of options. And I'm wondering if, for a lot of fantasy owners, if Kluber's jumped maybe out of that tier during the postseason. And now I wonder if we'll see him going before Sale or Bumgarner in drafts next year. And, you know, if he does, is that a smart decision? Like you said, when you look at his numbers the last three seasons, he's Bumgarner-like, where you kind of can't go wrong with him. Like, forget the wins, because that's not really his fault from 2015. But he is a little like Bumgarner, where you're getting heavy innings, you know, and plenty of strikeouts and solid ratios.
I think Sale is the question. I think if you look at the overall numbers and you look at, you know, particularly you look at the ERAs, and look, part of that is a factor of ballpark and league. So if you're just talking in a vacuum, it's a different question. If you're talking fantasy, which, you know, we are, you know, I have to put Bumgarner ahead of either of those dudes. Bumgarner hasn't had an ERA over 3 since 2012. Sale has had ERAs over 3 each of the past 2 years, as has Kluber. So I think that's a really interesting question. I think that is kind of, to me, I would put Bumgarner a clear 3 ahead of Sale. But I think it's a fair question whether you would rather have Sale or Kluber for a variety of reasons that start with, you know, one of them is, I think it's fair to say you're going to have a better offense and bullpen behind Kluber next year. And the other thing is, you know, the Sale we saw in the second half of last year was kind of a different pitcher and not necessarily less effective, but that dominating high strikeout guy, I think it's at least fair to wonder. I'm not docking him entirely. The overall numbers are very, very good. I think it's fair to wonder, will we see more of that slightly less strikeout-heavy Sale in 2017? And if so, I think that's an interesting question. And I think maybe right at 5 is a good place for Kluber. But I think if somebody wanted to argue for me, they'd rather have Kluber over Sale. I wouldn't say they were nuts.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And, you know, I brought up the workload concern because I wanted to discuss it. But to me, it's like you kind of mentioned, like a half tick drop or like a minor drop. To me, it's not a major one because we've seen pitchers like Bumgarner have, you know, these really heavy innings in the postseason and then come back and be totally fine the next season. Some pitchers, you know, just can't seem to stay healthy, and some pitchers manage to pile up these innings and it takes a long time before it ever really impacts their production. You know, so if we see an impact from these high innings from Kluber or from someone like Bumgarner, it may be down the road, like we saw with Felix Hernandez eventually, from just year after year of big innings. It may not be the following season.
Absolutely. But, you know, the flip side of that is that could start coming this year. I mean, he's had a lot of innings recent years, so I think it's fair to worry, but I really like the sort of consistency of the product. Staying with the your American League champion, Cleveland American League Baseball team, Mike Napoli has had a really rough postseason following a pretty rough down the stretch. You know, you look at his recent years. Well, first, you start with the fact that he turned 35 yesterday. So next year will be his age 35 season. He had a really good year this year, but a year ago, 224, 18 home runs. A year before that, 248, 17 home runs. You have to go back to 13 to find another year anything close to this year, 259, 23 homers, 92 RBI with the Red Sox. But to me, I think it is, I would be very wary of Napoli as anything but a late-season flyer on power opportunity. If I'm drafting now for a couple of reasons. One, just age and decline, and I think it's perfectly, you know, the old Bill James old player skills question I think is a fair one to have. When he goes, it could go real bad. The other thing I worry about a little bit with Napoli is as they get Brantley back next year, they've got a lot of guys to fit in maybe not that many spaces, and if Napoli doesn't produce, I don't think it's a guarantee that he plays that much. So at this point, if I'm drafting blind right now, if I'm in November drafting blind on what the Indians roster looks like in 17, I am way, way down on Napoli, even with the 34 home runs. Do you have more optimism for him than I do?
No, I don't. And I was interested to see, you know, what your take would be on him. And yeah, I think that some people may see 34 home runs, 101 RBIs and say, you know, this is someone who I can count on as a power producer next year. My guess is that this will be the last really productive year that we see from him. You know, if someone wants to project him for 20 home runs, an RBI total in the 70s next year, I would be okay with that. And, you know, and maybe you get pleasantly surprised. But that's kind of where my mind is at with him right now. I think that, you know, if you got Napoli cheap this year and you got to ride the wave and get those 34 homers, then congratulations. But I wouldn't count on it happening again.
That's exactly it. I think you're kind of looking for, and it's one of those things we talk about in non-fantasy and baseball analysis with relievers. You're looking for the next one. To some extent, you're looking for the next Mike Napoli. You're looking for the guy next year who has some history of doing it, gets an opportunity, and you get him late and you ride that wave. You don't want to be the guy who drafts somebody like that a year too late.
That's right. I mean, the only way you want him is if your whole league is, you know, in step on saying that a decline's coming and you get him really cheap. Yeah. I don't think that'll happen in most leagues.
Right. Somebody's gonna like him more than you or I do.
Yeah.
a really interesting guy. We move over to the National League champion Chicago Cubs, and a guy who I remain fascinated by because I don't entirely get it. Kyle Hendricks had an outstanding year. I think back, and I don't remember who it was, but going into 2015, there is a national baseball writer, and it might have even been one of ours at MLB.com, but it was a national baseball writer, one of the people who sort of is around at all the camps and sees a whole bunch of people, and said, one of those sort of, you send a tweet out, and if you're right, then you look like a genius, and if you're wrong, people have forgotten it by October anyway. And whoever this was, and I wish I remembered, I should look it up, and I apologize for that. Beginning of 2015, called Kyle Hendricks his Cy Young winner for 15, based on what he'd seen in spring training and presumably talking to some people around the organization and being really excited about it. That obviously didn't happen, but it got laughed at, and it could happen in 16. I still don't know what to do with this guy's sort of combination of skills, because I kind of buy the ERA. I kind of buy that he can, you know, if not continue 2-1-3, at least continue in the twos. I don't think he bursts all the way back to a 4 ERA, but 180 innings and 190 innings the last 2 years, 167 strikeouts, 170 strikeouts. I think we have a pretty good idea of what his true talent level, and it's sort of in between those two. So what do you do with that? Is that, how high do you rate a guy who's not a huge innings monster, not a huge strikeout guy, but probably is going to get you an ERA somewhere around 3.0, high twos? What do you do with that?
Yeah, I think the big thing working in Hendricks' favor is that the Cubs, no matter what finishes off here in the World Series, are probably the odds-on favorite to have the most wins in baseball next season and also have an outstanding defense. And that was one thing this year, you know, his BABIP's quite low this year. People will initially see that and think, oh, it's really, he's been really fortunate this year. But the Cubs have played great defense this year, and he's not the only pitcher. Lester's also benefiting from that. So, I mean, that could, with the same pieces in place, they could play the same great defense behind him next year. He's been way better the third time through the lineup this season. I think we're seeing someone who's a different kind of low-end ace, but maybe is a low-end ace, and maybe you need to pair him with a high strikeout, you know, a little higher ratio number two starter. But I think that he is now in that discussion as a low-end ace. If you're thinking an ERA in the twos after we just saw offense come up last season, then he has to be there in the top 12 starters.
Let me compare him to a guy who's kind of the opposite of that. You look at David Price, who in recent years has had one season under a 3 ERA going back the last four seasons, has one season under a 3 ERA, but piles up innings, piles up strikeouts, will probably also have wins. They're two just completely opposite kind of pitchers, and I think you probably would rather have Price for the strikeouts, but can you see a situation where, based on maybe somebody else you drafted or what else is on the board or how a draft is going, where you kind of have to make a decision between those two guys?
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, and I don't think it'll be, you know, too cut and dry. I could see the win totals for the two being, you know, pretty similar next year, since we do expect the Cubs to be so productive again next season. You know, it does seem quite likely that Hendricks will have the lower ERA and possibly WHIP next year. So, I mean, you're giving up 40 strikeouts, 50 strikeouts, which is significant, but I think it's pretty comparable. And maybe in a 10-team league, that's the kind of way to build your pitching staff. So you let all the pitchers we mentioned earlier go by, the Klubers, the Sales, the Bumgarners, and you go back-to-back Hendricks and Price, or Price-Hendricks, and, you know, Hendricks has the ratios and Price has the innings and the strikeouts.
Staying with the National League champions, Javier Baez was sort of the story of the NLCS, has been, in a different way, one of the stories of the Cubs in the World Series. I the way he is getting exposed, and I see what the worry has been about him all along. This guy has no strike zone. And, look, that's the kind of thing that is going to get magnified in a long postseason series. I mean, there's no doubt about that. These teams, they have their meetings, they have their scouting reports, they have pitchers who can execute a plan, they have guys who can take advantage of a player like Baez. But I wonder, I sort of wonder what all of this run, this up and down postseason does to his value. Because, you know, if the Cubs don't win the NLCS, then Baez is probably going into 17 with inflated value based on some of the spectacular things and just based on how much kind of fun he is to watch. I think people just like this guy. They're excited about him. They see limitless potential. I kind of suspect that inflation may have been knocked out during this World Series, and that I don't see him as a discount option, but I think based on even relative to a week ago, Baez may be sort of fairly valued. How high are you on him going into next year?
I was not really buying the earlier on in the postseason the hype with him, and I saw some fantasy people tweeting out, you know, I'm going to pay big for Baez next season, and you know, I wonder who's going to compete against me to get Baez next season, and I kind of felt like it wasn't going to be me. And I think this World Series, and you're right, the World Series is going to be hard on hitters like him. Cleveland's pitching, you know, out of their minds right now. They've got someone with a lot of holes as you said, he really has no strike zone, and they're taking advantage of it. He's not going to face that kind of competition all next season, but I think it's more of a reminder that we shouldn't set our expectations for him too high. He has had a decent batting average 2 years in a row with a low walk rate, you know, but if we can get to 20 homers next year, that would be a really big improvement for him. But, you know, 20 homers and a dozen steals, that would certainly be useful in a regular mixed league, but not a massive. I'm not feeling yet. I'm not seeing something that to me says, oh, this guy's really figured it out. Here comes the big breakout.
We talked about him a couple of weeks ago through the lens of Rougned Odor, and I still think that's not a terrible parallel, because I think in a lot of ways they're pretty similar players. You know, Jonathan Scope's something of a similar player. How do you kind of rate those guys relative to one another going the next year? All middle infielders, all with significant power potential, all with major strike zone issues, but an ability to get a base hit despite that. How do you kind of rate those guys going into 17?
Yeah, to me, Odor would be head and shoulders above the others, just because he has shown now the power with the 33 home runs this year, the 14 steals this year, so he's shown the speed, and his, you know, daily use in the lineup is locked in. And then to me, Scope and Baez, I think that's a discussion as far as I could see Scope being the safer of the two, because, again, his playing time, I feel like, is pretty locked in. That means his power is pretty locked in. Baez, if he wasn't playing well, could just not play on a deep Cubs lineup, you know, a roster for a while, or not play regularly. And Baez is the one with a lot of potential. So to me, Odor would be significantly ahead of the other two. And then with the other two, who will probably be targets in the second half of your draft, it would kind of depend, you know, do I feel like I need to lock in a decent home run total from a middle infielder, that Scope, or do I feel pretty confident with where I'm at so far and I'm going to roll the dice on someone, and that's Baez.
Yeah. One more Cub before we move on. Jason Hayward continues to have just a really, really tough postseason. He's shown some signs of life in the World Series, but still not really going great. He hit .230 in the regular season, 49 RBI, 7 home runs. He did steal 11 bases. Is Hayward not even on the board in a 10-team mixed for 17?
Yeah, I think he probably isn't. I mean, it's been years now since we've seen like really notable power production from him. I don't feel confident saying he's going to steal 20 bases next season. If we're talking something like a dozen home runs and 15 steals, and his batting average typically isn't very high. I mean, he's .262 in his career. I just don't see why you'd chase that. And I'm a bit of a Hayward apologist. I haven't completely written him off for his career or anything like that, but in a 10-team league, I would rather later on like take a chance on someone like Baez and leave Hayward on waivers. And if Hayward's hitting .300 in April, then I'll take another look at him. Like I said, I haven't written him off, but to me there's been so much struggle here. I don't think I would draft him in a 10-team league, would you?
No, I would not. And I don't think you'd have to. I think the point you hit on is that I don't think you have to. So the more interesting question is, what do you have to get to before you're drafting him? Like, I would think in a 10-team NL only, you're certainly taking a chance on him. Where is the line in between 10-team mixed and 10-team NL only where, as a late-round flyer, you'd be interested in Hayward?
Yeah, in a 15-team league, I would want him for sure. I mean, as my fifth outfielder in a 15-team league, I would, or maybe my fourth outfielder, depending on how I, but no, I'm going to say more like fifth. And you hope he gets back into the maybe 70s in runs and 60s in RBIs or something. and maybe you're pleasantly surprised. In a 12-team league, it would probably depend on bench size. Like, maybe very late in my draft, like last couple rounds, I'd throw him on my bench and see how he opens the season the first couple weeks. But because that is still a really good lineup if he ever gets going. But, you know, I wouldn't go into a 12-team draft saying he's someone that I'm targeting in the late rounds, but I guess I would consider him.
We look back briefly at the NLCS, and I assume you were putting this on a tee for me to swing at. So I'm going to go ahead and swing. You note Kershaw's postseason performance and his injury issue, and ask, is he a top five pick? And to me, the answer is just an easy yes. This guy is still the best pitcher in the game, and frankly, I hope people look at his postseason ERA and don't look at how great he was in large chunks of this postseason and just what he was asked to do in an unfair set of circumstances in some cases. If I'm drafting four or five and Clayton Kershaw falls to me, unless Mookie Betts is also on the board, I am taking him without hesitating. I am laughing, I am grinning, and I am thanking the people who passed on him. Do you think this is am I overly blinded and not enough considering the health risk and October, or are you with me on this?
You know, you're right. You're right. I set it right up for you on the tee, and you put it right down the middle of the fairway. And I totally agree with you. To me, he's a top five pick for next year. I mean, some people philosophically don't want to take a pitcher in the first round, and if that's how someone feels, then that's fine. But assuming they have an open mind towards taking a pitcher in the first round, yeah, to me, he's a top five pick. I feel like he's as likely as any player, hitter or pitcher, to be the number one fantasy asset next season. Now, I'm totally fine with taking a Trout or a Betts or someone ahead of him. I get that. But, yeah, to me, he's as likely as anyone to be the most productive player next season. He's pitched so well in recent years. Like, forget this postseason. Like, he's if he makes 30 starts next year, you know, the ratios are going to be amazing. The strikeout total is going to be amazing. And he's going to carry your pitching staff.
But, again, here's the thing to me. Like, these narratives get built. This guy was really good. You know, I was at the division series that he pitched in, and he was amazing. I mean, that's, to me, I look at what he did in October, even given the ERA, and to me, that is as comforting as anything. This guy came back, played against the toughest competition, and showed in a big way. I think probably by the end, too much was asked of a guy who, again, is coming off an injury, had not gotten probably up to full strength before he started pitching. I think they probably just asked too much of him. But I look at Kershaw in October and I say, yep, he's fine.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it is interesting. I do find from just a fan perspective, it is interesting to me that he just has never had a postseason like Kluber's having or like Bumgarner's had. But to me, maybe one of the most interesting stats this postseason, in the series against the Nationals, he had a 5.84 ERA, and in that same series, he had a 0.84 FIP. So, yeah. I mean, this is just like these are small samples, and I don't think people should get carried away with them at all.
Yeah. So we move on, and we have, amazingly, we have a mock to discuss. The six-round Fantasy 411 mock is in the books, and there's certainly some interesting stuff in here, and I'm not entirely sure where to start. You had a couple things you asked about. I kind of want to start with, to me, as interesting a pick as any, and I'm not even sure what to do with it. I think at the end it's probably about the right spot. Bryce Harper goes 9 overall, late first round. Because he could be so good and because he could repeat last year and because he's probably somewhere in between, I feel like that's about reasonable, but when you look at Harper, where do you put him? What do you do with him?
Yeah, I think that this is kind of where he's going to fall, back into the first round, because if you look at the players picked around him, you know, Machado and Arenado went right before him, Donaldson, Seager, Blackman went right after him. I feel like he has a much better chance than any of those other players to be a top 1, 2, or 3 fantasy asset next season, but probably has more bust potential than any of them. I'm leaning optimistic on Harper. I know this was just the last year for him, but he was so good in 2015, and for so long he was projected to be great, that I feel like that's the right spot for him. I think once we're past the first six or seven picks, then he's totally in play.
Charlie Blackmon goes 12, coming off of his first year of more than 20 home runs, coming off a year in which his steals dropped mightily, and going into a year in which he will turn 30 on July 1. I think I'm giving away what I think of him that high. What do you think of him that high?
Yeah, I felt like that was a little aggressive. I don't mind Blackmon maybe later in round two, but on the like round 1-2 turn, I feel like that's maybe a little aggressive. I read something interesting on our site of around the middle of the season where he talked about his steals drop was a planned move. And he talked about how, you know, about not running into outs and about, you know, preserving your body and being smart. And, you know, this was something that he, you know, he basically said, you know, when I really feel very, very certain that I can take the base, I'll take the base. But I don't need to push my luck to prove, you know, how many bases I can steal. I've kind of already proven that. I'm not really confident that the steals are going to come back to a really
right.
large degree. I'm more confident that maybe that we'll see the power tail off a bit, because that was a big jump for him. So, yeah, like if you want to project like 20 home runs and 20-something steals and take him at the end of round two, I think that's good. But I'm not feeling first-round pick with him.
Here is the counter to that, and here's one of the other things that really jumps out to me about this mock, and that is that with the exception of the top two guys, Trout and Betts, and wherever you put Harper, you then look at the outfielders, and it doesn't look great. When you look at, you know, I'm just looking at how this went. Springer goes fourth pick of the second round. Marte goes mid to late second round. Ryan Braun, third round. Cespedes, Stanton, Cruz, Pollock, J.D. Martinez. With all of the ridiculous ability there is in the middle infield, with all of the third base talent that there is right now, with all the big bats at first base, outfield is a little thin. So my two questions for you, one is a very brief, just to kind of lead into the other, is does that affect how you would view a guy like Blackmon, who can produce in a lot of ways and does play regularly in Colorado? And two, how does that strategically affect how you approach outfielders in the early rounds of a draft?
Yeah, I think my early take for 2017 is that position scarcity is gone outside of the catcher position, at least for now. It'll be interesting to see as we get deeper into projections for next season if we can say that position scarcity has actually swung and outfield has gone from the deep position to the shallow position, but it seems to be trending in that direction. It makes me very willing to draft an outfielder in the first round, or even two outfielders in the first two rounds. You know, the same owner took Harper and Springer. I don't think that's a problem, because there aren't that many outfielders available, and if it's a five outfielder league, I used to feel, you know, in some of my drafts, if I came out with three outfielders in the first five rounds, oh, that's really too bad. You know, I like my talent, but later in the draft, there are going to be many more outfielders that I want, and I'm not going to have space for them. I don't think that's going to be the case this year.
A couple other things from this draft. Will Myers goes in the fourth round. That feels a little like a reach to me, because I'm pretty concerned by his second half fade. For example, Hanley Ramirez goes a little after. I probably feel, believe it or not, better about Hanley than Will Myers. Not believe it or not, for a lot of reasons, some of which include ballpark and lineup. Do you feel that's a little aggressive on Myers?
Yeah, a little bit. But I've never really been the high man on Myers, so it's one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up with you. And, you know, he did have, you know, really impressive totals this season. But, yeah, you put him in a Padres lineup that we'll see what happens in free agency, but probably won't be really productive again next season. And I'm quite worried about a decline, and I'm not feeling really confident of a repeat performance. Now, when I do look at the players picked after him, you know, immediately after him, a lot of them do have, you know, fair amount of flaws in their game, like a Hanley Ramirez, where you've got injury concerns and he's been inconsistent in recent years. So maybe that's about where Myers will shake down. Also, steals are at a premium right now, and he's someone who got you steals last season. So, you know, maybe it's about right, but to me it also does feel, at least at this point in the offseason, it feels a little aggressive.
I look at a guy who went a little after him who I would probably feel better about, and that's Christian Yelich. That's somebody I like a lot. Feel really good about the batting average. I think he came into his power at 24 rather than having a fluke year. Nine steals was a little down, but I think that's reasonable for him. You know, not the same position, but you look at what came after him. That's a guy that I might feel a little better about. A couple more things, and then we will wrap this up. Starting pitchers in this mock, not a lot of them went real early. Kershaw goes 6. Scherzer goes 15. Bumgarner, end of the second round. Sale, Kluber, Syndergaard in the third. And then in the fourth, you start getting into that next tier. Lester, Arrieta, Cueto. Struck by Chris Archer going really early, and as you know, I am an enormous Chris Archer fan, but boy, that feels early on him. How did the starters kind of shake down as you expected in this draft?
So I really had no idea how the other owners would value those starters, like in what order, and I feel like actually coming out of the mock that I still don't. I think what it reinforced to me is that opinions on these starters, once we get past that consensus of, you know, Kershaw, Scherzer, Bumgarner, Sale, Kluber, you know, mix them up just a little bit if you have a differentiating opinion, but there's about 5 there. Then it's, man, like Cueto as like the 7th starter to me. Like, I like Johnny Cueto, but that feels pretty aggressive. Arrieta is the 8th starter. He's really inconsistent in the second half. Like, there's just a lot. Yeah, we see, you know, Hendricks was a top 10 starter in this draft, and to me, maybe it reinforced that I might not mind taking Max Scherzer at the tail end of round 1 or early in round 2, yep. And maybe I can skip all those really volatile assets that I just mentioned, or wait until most of them go and then take, you know, one of them as my number 2 starter.
Yep. And then you look at the relievers. No relievers go in the first 5 rounds, and then 3 go in a row, and kind of an interesting sequence to me. Britton, Jansen, Chapman. I realize we don't know where Jansen's going to go. I would be hesitant to take Britton before Jansen or Chapman. I know Chapman could, I know either of those guys that they sign a free agent could be shoehorned into that 60 innings, one inning at a time, nothing more. But I also feel like those guys are capable of a little more than that and might get signed somewhere. Some spend of that money might get signed somewhere where they could give you more 70, 75 innings. How do you, 2 questions again. Do you like that sequence for those 3 guys, and do you think somewhere around pick 70 is a pretty reasonable place for them to start going?
Yeah, I think 6th round is fine in a 12-team league. I'm with you that I would put Britton after the other 2. For me, if I'm going to take a closer around 6, I'm looking for, obviously, the low ratios are a given. I mean, you're not taking a closer around 6 if you don't think you're going to get low ratios, and the 40 saves should be a given if you're considering a closer around 6. I want 100 strikeouts. Like, for me, I want 100 strikeouts, too. That's one of the bonuses. I don't think fantasy owners always value that as much as they should, but the difference between Chapman and Britton in strikeouts may not be that different from the difference of Kyle Hendricks and David Price that we were just talking about, how that would be a major factor with them. Maybe you get Hendricks and Chapman and someone else gets Price and Britton, and you get 2 guys with low ratios and the same amount of strikeouts. So I want the 100 strikeouts. That keeps Britton out of the top 2 discussion for me. I'm fine with him after that. I think I can't, off the top of my head, I'm not thinking of another starter who I feel, like, I don't feel good enough about Wade Davis or someone like that to put him ahead of Britton after the season Britton just had.
Yeah, I think the one guy that I would put in that conversation that we can't do this now, Patances is the guy in New York, Ben.
Yeah.
He's probably in that conversation.
Yeah, or Andrew Miller if things shook down, if Cody Allen was traded in the offseason or whatever. But, you're right. Those are the other 2 relievers that can get you. I mean, there's other relievers, Kyle Bearclaw and some guys who can get you 100 strikeouts, but they're not really close to saves.
Right.
Patances
right.
and Miller are the other 2 that we'll see where they end up by the end.
Yeah. All right, well, that's the Fantasy 411 for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Fred Dinky, for taking the time to talk.